Es ist mir nun ein großes Vergnügen, Ihnen Elsa von Freytag-Loringhoven in Form von Irene Gammerl, die dazu referieren wird, vorzustellen. Das wolltest du eigentlich du machen.
Ja, ja.
Okay? Also damit hätte ich den Stab Adrian Notz übergeben, der ihn dann weiter übergeben wird. Und ich bedanke mich für die Aufmerksamkeit.
Vielen Dank, Ina. Ich bin froh, dass du es doch noch gemerkt hast, weil ich könnte nicht so gut improvisieren zu den anderen Referentinnen, wo ich mich nicht vorbereitet habe. Irene Gammerl war ja bereits schon mal hier, ja, als wir diese Dada Baroness-Ausstellung unten in der Krypta hatten. Da. Wir sind sehr stolz, dass wir Irene Gammerl, diese ausgewiesene Spezialistin, für unsere Session gewinnen konnten. Und ohne Irene Gammerl wüssten wir kaum, wer die Dada Baroness Elsa von Freytag-Loringhoven ist. Und ein wichtiges Element ist dieses Buch. Wir machen auch gleich ein bisschen Werbung. Man kann es auch kaufen hier und unterschreiben lassen von Irene Gammerl. Das steht leider noch nicht. Dank Gammerl gehört das Schaffen der New Yorker Performerin, Dichterin und visuellen Künstlerin mittlerweile zum kunsthistorischen Kanon. Mit ihrer grundlegenden Biografie, die Dada Baroness, hat Gammerl 2013 die Dada Pionierin aus der Vergessenheit geholt. Die Performerin Marina Abramović zählt die Baroness zu ihren geistigen Müttern. Wenn es, Zitat, wenn es um bahnbrechende Kunst und um das Spiel mit den Geschlechtern geht, finden wir heutige Künstler kein gewagteres Beispiel als die lange vergessene Baroness Elsa. Irene Gammerl hat sich nicht nur mit der Performerin und Assemblage-Künstlerin auseinandergesetzt, sondern als Literaturwissenschaftlerin ebenso intensiv mit den Gedichten der Baroness. Unter dem Titel Body Sweats hat sie 2011 eine Auswahl davon publiziert. Irene Gammerl ist Professorin für Englisch an der Ryerson University in Toronto, Kanada. Sie leitet dort das Modern Literature and Culture Research Center und forscht zu Gender, Modernismus und Avantgarde. Bereits 2003, jetzt sage ich das, was ich schon am Anfang gesagt habe, dass sie ja schon mal hier war. Die Ausstellung über Elsa von Freytag-Loringhoven wurde ja nicht nur im Cabra Volta, das war ja nur eine kleinere, quasi abgespecktere Version davon gezeigt, sondern auch zur gleichen Zeit in Berlin. Und heute wird Irene Gammerl zu Elsa von Freytag-Loringhoven und dem Körper als Kunstwerk sprechen. Ich möchte noch kurz weitere technische Anleitungen machen. Wir reden alle Deutsch, aber es gibt einige Referentinnen, die Englisch reden. Sie dürfen aber ungeniert auf Deutsch fragen, weil die Auseinandersetzung mit Dada führt dazu, dass man Deutsch lernt. Genau. In diesem Sinne, Irene, bitte, it's yours.
Zuerst einmal herzlich willkommen. Es ist schön, so viele von euch zu sehen. Vielen herzlichen Dank für die wunderschöne Einführung und auch vielen herzlichen Dank an Ina für die Organisation dieses Symposiums. Und es ist ja auf jeden Fall sehr, sehr timely auch, dass wir uns auseinandersetzen über Körper, Frauen und Dada. Also es gibt schon interessante Forschung und ich glaube, es ist immer faszinierend, wenn man dann sieht, wie alles zusammenkommt, dieses Synthesizing of various ideas. Und das finde ich schon ganz, ganz toll. Und die neue Forschung, die dann damit wieder raufkommt, damit können wir auch wieder eine ganze Menge machen. Also vielen herzlichen Dank dafür. Und ich muss auch sagen, es ist auch wunderschön, hier wiederum im Cabaret Voltaire zu sein. Also, wie soll ich sagen, es ist historisch jetzt. Wir feiern das 100. Und das ist schon mal ganz, ganz toll, wenn man sich vorstellt, dass Dada 100 Jahre alt ist und so einen großen Einfluss gehabt hat, dass wir uns immer noch mit Dada auseinandersetzen, dass es heute so viele Bücher gibt über Dada. Ich glaube, das ist schon sehr, sehr beeindruckend, wenn man sich vorstellt, dass vor 100 Jahren die Künstler Hugo Ball, die Janko-Brüder, Emmy Hennings und alle anderen, dass sie hier waren, Tristan Tzara, und sich damit auseinandergesetzt haben und eine ganz faszinierende Kultur und Literatur und Performance gemacht haben, die dann auch sehr provokativ war und dann auch auf andere Städte ausging. Also das finde ich schon sehr, sehr toll, und ich glaube, die Stadt Zürich kann da sehr, sehr stolz drauf sein, dass man eben das Cabaret Voltaire hat. Obwohl, ich muss als Anekdote sagen, ich konnte mich nicht mehr genau erinnern, wo es war. Und als wir dann gekommen sind an der Marktgasse, da haben wir dann gefragt, ja, wo ist denn das Cabaret Voltaire? Und die Frau wusste nicht, wo es war. Und da sagte ich zu Paul, meinem Partner, oh, da ist ein Briefmann, der ist der Mailman, der weiß das ganz bestimmt. Da sind wir zum Mailman gegangen und haben gefragt, wo das Cabaret Voltaire ist. Und er hat gesagt, oh, ich bin hier neu, ich weiß das noch nicht. Und dann habe ich auch gesagt, das ist schade, ne? Das Cabaret Voltaire, das ist das Allererste, was man erfahren muss in der Spiegelgasse. Aber wir haben es trotzdem gefunden. Okay, so thank you very much, und ich werde den Vortrag auf Englisch halten, aber auf jeden Fall Fragen sind willkommen auf Deutsch und Englisch. Ich hatte noch einen ganz anderen Prolog geschrieben, aber vielleicht können wir die für die Fragen erhalten. Also auch über Dada Club, ja, da gibt es ja auch interessante Verbindungen zu der Baroness Elsa, die auch für Dada Globe beigetragen hat. Vielleicht können wir später dann darüber reden. Und entschuldige, meine Stimme ist heute nicht so gut, aber wir werden schon durchkommen. Geht's so? Können die alle hören durchs Mikrofon? Super. Bisschen mehr? So? Besser so? Ja? Super. Dankeschön. So here comes the Baroness. All America is nothing but impudent, inflated, rampantly guileless burghers, tradespeople, and I alone cannot fight a whole continent. So raged the German Baroness Elsa von Freytag-Loringhofen in 1922 in a letter that she had submitted to the Little Review. And the Little Review at the time was one of the most avant-garde journals. So a very transnational journal, was published in New York at the time, but also later on in Paris. The Baroness, as she was called, was an experimental poet. She was also a body artist who staged herself as a work of art, a form of living Dada, as the Little Review editors would describe it later on in their Dada manifesto. A war widow in New York, she was notorious for excoriating America's cultural icons during the World War I era. And she really was in New York from 1913 to about 1923, so she crossed that war area as well as the post-war era. She had an important impact in shaping New York Dada and has been the focus of my studies, notably two books. And here we see the gender-bending Baroness in her performance costume. And what I find fascinating about it is that she has the what one might call a dazzle costume with the pattern of the pants itself, as well as an aviator hat adorned with a feather. Notice too, you have the fascinating sort of everyday objects around the umbrella, the canary that she used at times in her performances, as well as the top, the mail jacket that was also used later on in the photograph of others, and various other objects, as well as the ballet slippers, which is quite fascinating too. Referencing the cataclysmic war, this sort of striking cubist pattern evokes the dazzle camouflage painted on ships and airplanes to confuse aerial observers and disorient the enemy. And in 1915, she was interviewed then by the New York Times, and it was very much in context of that famous name that she had, Freitag Loringhofen, famous German military family. So that certainly attracted the attention. "I'm not merely the model who poses," she told the New York Times reporter in the summer of 1915, "driven by that raging protest against the conventional, I seek to give artistic expression." This was a boldly new art form for which the name had not yet been invented. And in this talk, I would like to explore the Baroness's vivid and truly impactful innovation. And that is her transference of performance from the theater stage to everyday life. Yeah, her performance of herself in the everyday, what today we would call performance art. I focus on her fusion of art and life as the Baroness embraced a form of art that was both creative and dangerous. Ultimately, I argue in this talk, as I've done in my book, that the Baroness was a catalyst in New York who infused her iconoclastic vision of art into others who would enter her orbit. And those were quite a few. Yeah, think of Marcel Duchamp, Man Ray, the American photographer, but also the poets and painters at the time, such as William Carlos Williams and various others. Since others ignited their own creative practices through the Baroness, she was a kind of creative spark plug who helped set in motion New York's modernity. Now, to begin, briefly recall New York during the war years, seen here in a painting by Florine Stettheimer. And it's interesting, Frances Naumann includes Florine Stettheimer also within the group of Dadaists. Yeah, in his sort of retrospective on New York Dada, Florine Stettheimer had a very important place as well, even though her artworks are much more whimsical than we would find it in other Dada artworks. What's interesting about this, here we see certainly the patriotic motifs, liberty here, as well as the Hudson River, and there we can see the ship with the cannon there in the foreground, as well as the American flag, and Manhattan, of course, in the background. What's fascinating about it is the view of Manhattan with the skyscrapers rising. With war raging in Europe, New York, very much like Zurich, had become a safe haven for expatriate European artists who tried to escape conscription or who were deemed unfit for war. In 1915, artists like Marcel Duchamp, Francis and Gabriel Picabia, Juliette Rush, Jean Crotty arrived in the New World and joined their American counterparts, yeah, such as Man Ray, the photographer. He was pioneering photography as art at that time. But also American painters like Joseph Stella, Marston Hartley, and poet William Carlos Williams, who was at the time burning with the lust to write, as he would later put it in his memoir. Here, within a loosely assembled group of experimental and proto-Dada artists, the Baroness became, ironically, given that she was a German citizen, she became the first American Dada, as it was later described in the Little Review, who embodied the Little Review's motto, making no compromise with the public taste. Yeah, there you can really see that sort of radical slashing against bourgeois or mainstream aesthetics. Now, what exactly is Dada? And what is Dada in New York? Dada, of course, was the wild offspring of the First World War, a movement born very much of displaced refugees and exiles, which is one of the most fascinating things, I think, about Dada, this kind of crossing of multiple nationalities. Yeah, wherever we see Dada, it's never just in one sort of national formation. It's always a crossing of various nationalities. It was also a fiercely anti-bourgeois protest movement in art, active in Zurich, as we know, where the term Dada was first coined in February of 1916, before moving to Paris, Berlin, Hanover, many other cities in the world. So it was also a city phenomenon. Dada was militant, and Dada sought to provoke and shock. It also sought to dismantle traditional aesthetic forms. Dada gave birth to new forms, and already yesterday we've heard also about the productive elements of Dada. Yeah, notice the found object, the ready-made, the collage, the assemblage. All of these were formed, shaped within Dada. And here in the slide we see the two portraits that the Baroness made of Marcel Duchamp. On the left, the portrait of Marcel Duchamp as an assemblage sculpture. And we can see here how she serves her colleague Duchamp like a dessert in a wine glass. Yeah, and the wine glass, of course, quite interesting because the glass itself referencing Duchamp's large glass, yeah, the famous work that he was working on, as well as potentially referencing the fact that he was also a little bit of a boozer. He was, like a lot of the artists at the time, heavily into the alcohol, as well as others who were heavily into the drugs, yeah, which has also been theorized as being part of sort of the trauma of the time, this sort of seeking escape in alcohol and self-destruction, basically. The work is at once a portrait and self-portrait. Yeah, we see, for example, the feathers here, and we also see this sort of assemblage of organic and inorganic material, and this sort of jumbling of everything together, which was a classic feature of what the Baroness did. And so, in a way, we see, looking at Duchamp, at this portrait of Duchamp, we also see the Baroness at the same time. And that's what she wanted us to do. Yeah, with everything, she wanted us to look at herself. The second portrait, a collage, which I just had the pleasure of seeing in the museum in Jerusalem, where it is held. A beautiful, beautiful work. She obviously put a lot of work into this one. And where we see Marcel's name spelled out in the left corner over here. Notice, too, what I find fascinating about this one. One could say a lot of things about it, but what I find fascinating about it is that we have sort of pre-Columbian referencing. Notice the portrait itself is a sort of pre-Columbian mask, and then these talismans at the body, at the bottom, and even over here, the little crown that is often a reference for the Baroness herself. Yeah, she will often sign even some of her poems with this little crown that you will find in various places. Notice, too, probably people here recognize the wheel here to the right. And the wheel, of course, the famous bicycle wheel ready-made, so she really pays tribute to Duchamp. But what's fascinating about it is that she takes this mechanical bicycle wheel and she turns it, notice, into what? A kind of spider web. Yeah, so it becomes organic again. She transforms it and makes it her own. Whereas Duchamp represented the cerebral in art, really celebrating that art of the mind, the Baroness always brings us back to the body. And I'm pretty sure she would quibble with Hugo Ball that the body is sort of the art form of the bourgeois. She saw the body very much as something that slashes through the bourgeois, something that she chose as her guide. So she will always, whether it's poetry, whether it's performance, whether it's visual art, she will always link us, bring us back to the body itself. That's a kind of, if there is a unifying feature in what the Baroness did, it's the body. It's an unequivocal celebration of the body. And so the body became her dada vehicle to combat aesthetic tradition and bourgeois pretension. The Baroness's dada also represented an extreme of sorts. Yeah. Sooner or later, everybody who knew the Baroness had enough of her. Yeah. At the beginning, it was always fun and so forth, but she would always push a few buttons too many, and people would turn on her. So in that sense here, Dada deliberately, and the Baroness's Dada certainly courted obscenity, focusing on waste products. Yeah. That's an element that she kind of championed. And that certainly was controversial, this sort of embracing of wastage as a matter of art. And I think it still remains very controversial today. But I think it is a fascinating way of embracing art or of championing new forms of art during a time when human life was squandered by the millions on the battlefields, and soldiers were forced to live in the mud, confined to underground labyrinths and dugouts. Yeah, remember, some of them for 4 long years. Like no other art form, the Baroness's Dada conjured this material reality by presenting bathroom matter, dirt, and the lower bodily functions. I'm just going to get a little more water, sorry. The goal was to stir up feelings of, or extreme feelings, including feelings of disgust, rather than soothe spectators with comforting aesthetic pleasure. Shock, provocation, and ridicule were the goal. Collages, sound poetry, profanity, and aggressive attacks on valued value system were the medium that carried this message. Seen here in the slide on the left is the assemblage sculpture God, the Baroness's collaboration with Morten Schomburg, which presents perhaps a sort of quintessence of New York Dada. It consists of a twist of bathroom plumbing fixtures mounted on a mitre box and pointing to heaven. And then, of course, the sacrilegious title, God. Not only is God given a body, but God is linked to wastage in this particular context. So a sacrilegious word, the sculpture aimed to deflate the power of God and religion. Quote, "I spit on an unsuccessful Christ," she raged in her autobiography. "I like the proud Satan state better." Such a fierce critique reminds us that God and religion were key in the recruitment of soldiers on both sides of the trenches. Yeah, it's also fascinating, even after the war, many priests, I'm just doing a lot of research in Canada because Canada was involved in that First World War right from day one. Yeah, as a colony, they were automatically involved in the war, didn't have a choice. And what was fascinating is the kind of sort of trauma and shock and guilt that priests had after the war, because it was priests who, of course, helped very much in that process of recruitment before conscription came in early 1918 in Canada. Yeah, it was the soldiers went, and about 500,000 soldiers went from Canada, fighting at Vimy and in Flanders Fields. In this context, the rawness of the brass pipe also conjures the detonated brass shells in Belgium and France, which were often repurposed by the soldiers for trench art. This 1917 work perfectly also coincides then with America's entrance into war in 1917. The god sculpture also works as a sister piece to fountain. The infamous urinal signed R. Mutt and typically attributed to Duchamp. And I don't want to go into the controversies of that today. That's for a different day, a different story. But it was submitted as a work of art in 1917 for the Independence Exhibition. And here on the right, we see Fountain on a pedestal in Alfred Stieglitz's studio. Stieglitz took the photograph of the original with the urinal rotated on its back. And what's fascinating here, photographed against Marston Hartley's painting, Warriors. So an interesting connection here to the war as well with that particular work. And I'm sure one could say much, much more about it, but we'll move on and stay with the Baroness and turn to one of my favorite works, and that is Limpswish. So from 1913 to 23, the Baroness used New York's consumer culture and Manhattan's urban street landscape as a raw material for her art. And she was really one of the first to make art out of the junk that she picked from the streets. Quote, Sarah, if you find a tin can on the street, stand by it until a truck runs over it. Then bring it to me, she told her friend Sarah McPherson. And this is one of Francis Naumann's favorite quotations. He always brings it up, and he says that's actually a strategy that years later we find in Monterey. Yeah, he's using a similar approach to art. In her flat, she collected celluloid, tin cans, toys, gilded vegetables, scrap iron, stamps, pins, and so on. And these were objects that she had either found on the streets or that she had stolen in Wanamaker's or Woolworth's department stores. Yeah, so she was always keen to get some of the more recent products and make them part of her art. Decades ahead of her time, she applied these mass-produced items to as sculptures. Yeah, she was always clear that these were artworks and applied them to her body. So here we see the Limpswish assemblage, which was just repaired in New York. It is a large whip-like device, as you can see, made of a golden curtain tassel and a large metal spring. And what I find also fascinating is that there is a little bit of a Christmas tree candle holder clip at the very end.
Notice over here.
And I wasn't sure at first, but since it was under repair, I wrote to Mark Kelman, who owns this object, and I said, could one of you or could a specialist examine this and see, I believe this is a Christmas tree candle holder. And he says, wow, that's interesting. And they came back and they said, yes, that's what it is. And it's actually attached with wax, which is interesting. So we'll need to dig into that one a little bit deeper. But what's interesting is that the title itself is an erotic pun on limb swish and limbs wish. And of course, Eros is what the Baroness was all about, who was always chasing men. And after she finished chasing men, she was also creating connections with women, notably Juna Barnes later in life. The Baroness wore this Limpswish ornament attached to her hip belt. One might almost say like a cowboy might wear a Colt revolver. And apparently with that, she walked back and forth on the streets and created her own live Dada body music. What I find also fascinating about it, though, and again here looking at this within the context of the war and the fact that she was a war widow, the colored tassels were used to hold the German soldiers' bayonets, played a very important role also in terms of the color that they had, that told the sort of regiments, and so that the swashbuckling Baroness's enormous tassel also in some ways alluded to the war itself. And so she walked along the streets and
pioneered a new artistic form, performance art. And it's interesting to note then that there are visual echoes of Limswish in Mon Ray's well-known 1920 unfurled lamp shade sculpture made of paper and mounted at the time on a tall mannequin stand. Yeah, it's we see it in the middle slide picture. And this was lost later on when he went to Paris. But what is interesting is that this lampshade keeps reappearing. He uses it again and again in his photography. And we see it, for example, in a Paris photograph of Dadaist Tristan Tzara and Jean Cocteau, where now the unfurled lampshade is reapplied to the body. Whereas the Baroness centrally showcased the body, here the male bodies are entirely veiled by fabric. In this photo, the lampshade spiral acts like the Baroness's long dash in her poetry. Yeah, those of you who know the poetry, she uses this long dash again and again, so at times it creates long tails. And she uses it kind of in a bidirectional way to both sever and connect. Yeah, always those two. And I think this lampshade works a little bit in the same way in this photograph, both severing and connecting the two heads in this very edgy, fascinating group portrait. Imagine then the Baroness in 1915 to 1923, wildly parading attached objects to her body, including the tomato can bra that you alluded to, and this long before Andy Warhol turned the Campbell tomato soup can into art. With her art imprinted on her body, she commandeered a new audience of street spectators. And she took art out of the museum spaces and made it a part of the everyday space, confronting, shocking, but also amusing the street spectatorship. And since she claimed this public space for herself as an artist, and her art was all the more controversial as it was erotically charged. What we can raise the question, what exactly is the meaning of such art? And of course, there are many explanations. But perhaps one way of looking at it is to say that through her body, the Baroness engaged the viewer with the living city by creating powerful, eroticized emotions, but also surprise, shock, connecting spectators with the city itself. Another way of looking at it is to go to our favorite Dadaist Hugo Ball and look at it within the context of Zurich Dada. Hugo Ball has described the project of Dada as a way of de-automatizing the public, what he called de-automatisieren. Dada was, quote, to conceive everyday life in such a way as to retrieve it from its modern state of colonization by the commodity form. And in a way, the Baroness lived that principle. She stripped the found object of its utilitarian meaning, decolonizing it from its commodity status and creating artistically liberating epiphanies for her viewers. The focus on consumer items also created a self-conscious critique of capitalism and commodification. The Baroness used the consumer object even in her experimental poetry, creating a collage poetry of poetic ready-mades that incorporate consumer items, as in her famous Subjoyride poems. She has two poems entitled Subjoyrides, one and two. And I just want to read, just to give you a better sense of the Baroness's poetry as well, to just read one short, we can't even call it a stanza, but a short verse here. So she starts this poem with the lines, and that's not shown on this slide, ready to wear American soul poetry, the right kind. And then I skip to page 2, which is shown here in the slide, where you see her handwriting as well. Lux Camel, hands off the better Bolognese beauty. Get this straight. Wrigley's, Pinot's heels for the wise. Nothing so Pepsodent, soothing, Pussy Willow, kept clean with Philadelphia cream cheese. So, and you can see how she kind of marries all of this together. Notice we have the Lux Camel cigarettes, the Wrigley's chewing gum, we have Pepsodent toothpaste, and so on and so on. And we can see the Baroness on the subway, kind of chasing along in New York and seeing those advertisements and just grabbing and appropriating and incorporating that into her poetry. Her anti-commercialism is perhaps best encapsulated in an act recorded by the American painter George Biddle in his memoir. As Biddle recalls, in 1922, she intruded into the Belle Maison Gallery at a Wanamaker's department store, so kind of confronting commercial art, right? And we see a reenactment here with Brittany Murphy, the Hollywood actress who just died a few years ago and who impersonated the Baroness, of course, with expensive designer clothing. So you can see here, we can also see the appropriation of Dada, yeah, in today's context. Yeah, this is a kind of grittiness that can be appropriated and channeled to sell expensive designer clothing today. So here's George Biddle's recollection. And I should also mention George Biddle went to war in 1917 and also became a war artist in America. And the Baroness wrote him poetry and sent him poetry from New York to the war front. So he recalls later on, "I saw the Baroness standing on top of the staircase leading to the gallery, haranguing with unmeasured violence the sheep-like crowd below who had come for their homeopathic dose of modernity. She had rehung the entire show, each picture at a different angle and one or two upside down, while others lay face down on the carpet, and she was now inveighing in the most truculent manner against the bourgeois spirit of a department store which, in hanging modern art, had achieved the uninspired symmetry of a parking lot." So you can see the Baroness in action, unafraid, undaunted, kind of to make her points. Decades ahead of her time, her Dada struck at the notion of art as consumption, anticipating then also very postmodern critical understandings of performance by deliberately abusing the commercial spaces of art. And in this way, she also attacked some of her colleagues, yeah, including Duchamp and Man Ray. For her, the others never went far enough. And of course, Man Ray himself was made his money as a fashion photographer very soon in Paris, yeah, publishing in Vogue magazine, etc., etc. And so the Baroness said, "Beauty is ever dead in America." Yeah, this was just a couple of years before she left, and still she kind of continued to produce her art. According to performance theorist Peggy Phelan, performance is a very risky art form in that it is ephemeral. Yeah, it's kind of here one moment and then it's gone. It makes a flash and then it disappears. And yet its power, as Peggy Phelan explains, consists in this very disappearance, in its descent into memory, into unconscious. Quote, "The more dramatic the appearance, the more disturbing the disappearance." The Baroness's art descended into memory, and her performances are available to us today only in mediated form. Yeah, we have the memoirs where some of the anecdotes are described. We have autobiographies. We have photographs. But even a photograph is kind of just a staged moment. And we have a bit of a film still.
And here in the slide we can see some of the paintings. Yeah, she modeled for painters. Her good friend was Teresa Bernstein in New York, who painted these paintings that we have here of the Baroness, one in the nude and the other one here with her paint box and the candle. And a third one that we believe is the Baroness, who was very fond of animals and also had a parrot. Now, this sort of documenting of her art also gives us a little bit of a sense of the appropriation of her art that needs to be discussed. In 1921, the Baroness performed in Monre's first film experiment, which unfortunately is lost. All we have today is one still that has survived in a letter that shows the Baroness's exuberantly bared body and surrounded by Monre's lettering here, Mère de la 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 Mère de l'Amérique. And of course we can see the Baroness's letters here posing in form of the letter A, so that we also have a bit of a scatological joke, very much in the spirit of Dada and the whole kind of thrust against America. Such daring and uninhibited bearing of her body, as you can see in just that tiny, tiny still, illustrates what the Baroness herself called her virile and anti-stereotyped body, posing of the body as art. Yeah, that was her way of looking at this. So always in this sort of queering, crossing the gender boundaries. Yeah, she occupied a male position by being this aggressive in her self-representation. But it also made it difficult to represent this art for public consumption. So even within the context of Dada, this was an art form that could be shown only, as it was in this case, in a private letter to Tristan Tzara, written by Man Ray. And he simultaneously declared the death of Dada in New York. He just to read a couple of sentences. Cher Tzara, Dada cannot live in New York. All New York is Dada and will not tolerate a rival, will not notice Dada. There is no one here to work for it, no money to be taken in for it or donated to it, so Dada in New York must remain a secret. The taming of such poses is perhaps best illustrated in Man Ray's coat stand, which was featured in the only issue of the New York Dada magazine. Yeah, that's where we find this picture. And it's a photograph, and we are still researching, for which either the Baroness or Berenice Abbott performed as a model. The image is staged with the model hiding behind a coat stand mannequin. And notice she is wearing a single black stocking, which makes her leg look amputated against the dark background and the harsh lighting. So published in New York Dada, it was published right above Tristan Tzara's mock authorization that granted the magazine the permission to use the title Dada for New York, which was interesting. And that, by the way, was during the very same time that the Dada Globe discussions were taking place. And in that context, too, the Baroness submitted some of her work to Tristan Tzara. Here, the model's name is removed. The nude is reduced to an object to hang clothing on, creating overtly misogynist overtones. And the female nude is branded here as an immobile Dada doll. Yeah, it was kind of just titled Dada Photo. Yeah, it became a generic Dada Photo. While other artists energized themselves by channeling the Baroness's artistic vision, her own art and name were eventually forgotten and lost. And here's our friend. We've already seen him last night. Man Ray's 1921 photograph of Duchamp, cross-dressed in female garb as Rose Célavie, is a case in point. There is no doubt that Duchamp's use of the body as art And these gender-bending motifs were inspired by his friend, the Baroness, who had been performing the body as art from at least 1914 on, and who had also embraced that strongly androgynous language. Yeah, we see that as part of her grammar in what she does in Dada. While Duchamp was embraced as the pioneer of avant-garde art in the 20th century, the Baroness was forgotten, only to be rediscovered in our own postmodern era. Yeah, we certainly have quite a bit of her within the last two decades. She left us with her keen responses in poetry, collages, and sculptures that also connected New York Dada to Paris Dada. In the remarkable collage, Dada Portrait of Berenice Abbott, held today in New York's Museum of Modern Art, the Baroness exuberantly showered Berenice Abbott and at the time, Berenice Abbott was Manet's assistant. Yeah, she later on became a photographer in her own right. But here she really showers her friend with avant-garde jewelry, in that we have gilded eyelashes, a copper belt buckle, and notice also the earrings. Yeah, the earrings are again the Duchampian ready-made. Yeah, here the shovel over here, you can see it there, right there. And there's your dog Pinky. So there are always the self-referencing in these artworks as well. But when Berenice Abbott ignored the Baroness, okay, so we'll wrap up very soon. When Berenice Abbott neglected her, the Baroness used her art to accuse her friend in this collage to the right, where she writes, "Forgotten like this parapluies am I by you, faithless Berenice." And notice how she elegantly here misspells parapluie in order to make it rhyme. So just to conclude very, very briefly, the question then is, what attracts us to the Baroness today? Yeah, why this resurgence of the Baroness? After being forgotten for decades, after her mysterious death at a relatively young age in 1927 in Paris, she has made a dramatic resurgence over the past two decades and has been the focus of a novel by New York artist Renee Steinke, for example. There has been performance art by Lena Burke, for example, in Norway, Berlin, and her poetry has been published. So we have a lot of elements that kind of were inspired by the Baroness. For me personally, it was her daring and her originality, also her absolute abandon into art, that contrasts with popular icons of the time. The burning of her own blood, as she puts it, was perhaps, as the fuel for art, was an apt metaphor for an art that was sort of corporeal and also kind of showed something of the passion she had for art, which knew no bounds and which contrasts with other artistic models. The poem that seemed to encapsulate the era was T.S. Eliot's Proof Rock, in which the protagonist is afraid to live. "I have measured out my life in coffee spoons," says Proof Rock in what Robert Adams has called the most terrifying of lines in 20th century literature. The Baroness was the antidote to safe living. She always risked it all and made the principle of what she called motion and emotion the motto of her life. As she says it herself in the cast iron lover poem, "Look full of laughter, look full of motion, look full of dizziness, insanity, which make a steady and sane, make a steady and sane thine body." Thank you very much. Super.
So you can ask quick questions and quick answers.
Quick questions, quick answers. Super.
I have two questions.
Sure.
So, when was the portrait of Marcel Duchamp done? Was that also a reference to Rose Célarie? I read the glass I read that, but the rest, it's sort of, you know, very funky. So what was it before?
The fascinating thing is the collage itself, I always thought, was done around 1920. When I was in Israel, the back was inscribed circa 1919. I don't yet know who indicated the 1919. The collector at the time was Arturo Schwarz, the famous surrealist collector. So we don't know yet. The Baroness herself was not the most diligent in keeping track of all of this. She had all of this material, but it wasn't really registered very much. So where we get most of our dates from, let's say the historical dates, is when we have corroboration from newspapers, from others, from letters, and so forth. That's what gives us the most information. And the sculpture, sculpture itself was published in the little review. I believe that was 1920. Let me see. And that was part of the, that should have been indicated in the slide itself. But I believe that one was 1920. I went past it, right? Yeah, okay. Okay, but we can talk about that after, yeah.
Okay, second question. The first time I was in New York, it was this pipe piece was just named for Morton Schomburg.
Morton Schomburg.
And now, Morton Schomburg actually worked in totally different in his art. But were there other corporations? And how did he find out that now she is number one? And Morton Schomburg is just an associate or assistant or whatnot?
It's actually a lot of research has been done on that particular object. The very first scholar who did the reattribution from Morton Schomburg to the Baroness was Francis Naumann. And Francis Naumann discovered, his point was, number one, it's not part of the aesthetic of a Morton Schomburg at all. It's so different. Yeah, you have this gritty kind of object that was obviously created around that time of America's entrance into World War I. But the Baroness was in Pennsylvania at that time, and that's where she met Morton Schomburg. They knew each other really, really well. And the latest sort of theorizing is as follows. Morton Schomburg had a strong part in it. The Baroness probably found it. The Baroness probably also titled it. This title, God, she had so many references to God that was probably what she contributed to the collaboration. In other words, the concept itself. What Morton Schomburg, however, did, he mounted it and he also painted it because it is silver painted. And we know Morton Schomburg, that was again part of his trademark. He painted these artworks. There has been a recent article by Taylor, which is a wonderful article, and it was reprinted in the Dickerman, the big Dickerman catalog on New York Dada. So that might be the article to look at. He has it all in details. And there is also a lot of sort of physical evidence where her name already appears in a lot of the literature. And that had been, I mean, the sort of canonization is very often kind of along the major names and along some of the male names. And so now she is being reinscribed. There are others who are very much not in favor of this. I know that Mark Hellman holds very strong opinions and says, no, this is Morton Schomburg's and we should not be doing this kind of thing. You know. But at the same time, I'm convinced by the evidence. I didn't come up with that argument, but I'm convinced by the evidence presented. I believe this was thoroughly a collaborative work, just like Dada. A lot of what Dada does is collaborative. It's not Dada itself undercut notions of traditional authorship. So I believe that this kind of collaborative component is very much part of it. And of course it bugs the art historians today, because art historians love to know whose is it and how much is it worth. That's why it matters. So, and that's why we should be suspicious of that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm afraid you can't have a third question. because you are around, so
we'll continue discussion.